Medicaid enrollment is lower than expected. Meanwhile, voters will consider work requirements for Medicaid this fall. From SDPB, today is Monday, April 15th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, SDPB's Lee Strubinger helps explain why the state's Medicaid rolls have shrunk and who might qualify for assistance in the future. We'll explore the nature of work requirements for Medicaid and why some advocacy groups say they're a bad idea. Plus, students at the University of South Dakota have the chance to navigate the world by studying some of humanity's iconic travelers. We'll talk with Professor Tim Shorn about teaching travel writing. That's later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The number of South Dakota Medicaid expansion enrollees is lower than expected. Now, lawmakers want voters to approve whether the state can pursue additional requirements for those Medicaid recipients, and some worry that will result in even fewer eligible individuals with coverage. SDPB's Lee Strubinger reports.
They say big changes come in threes, and that's the case for Department of Social Services Secretary Matt Althoff, who's held the position for just over a year. During that time, he's overseen three changes to the state's Medicaid program, unveiling a new back-end program for Medicaid applications, rolling out voter-approved Medicaid expansion, and removing those from Medicaid coverage who no longer qualify following the end of a public health emergency. That emergency prohibited states from scrubbing its Medicaid rolls. Last spring, the number of Medicaid enrollees was at 154,000. Secretary Althoff says the department scrubbed about 30,000 individuals once the emergency lapsed.
Our team began a process methodically. We followed all CMS guidelines, Center for Medicaid, Medicare Services, to say how many of those cases can we do, and this is a big lift for our team.
Roughly 30% of enrollees were dropped from South Dakota's Medicaid rolls. The 27% drop in children covered by Medicaid even caught the eyes of the federal government. Althoff says a top reason people lost Medicaid coverage was for better pay.
The reasons why individuals through this unwinding became disenrolled was, well, they made more income, right? They got a job. And I think that's a big something that we celebrate, right? Is that the gainful employment was achieved and now they're receiving adequate income or by federal poverty level standards, and we hope to, don't always know, but with the benefit of health insurance.
Medicaid is 30% of the state budget, the largest budget item for the state. This year, the state is spending just over $365 million to cover its share of Medicaid. The federal government picks up the remaining $1 billion. Medicaid is about to get even more expensive for the state when the federal incentive to expand Medicaid runs out. State lawmakers and the governor have already set aside $31 million to ease covering that cost. And state Republicans are already pushing a change to Medicaid, this one in the form of a ballot question. Some want voters to clarify whether they'll allow lawmakers to pursue a Medicaid work requirement waiver. Republican Representative Tony Venhuizen is a primary backer of the question that will appear on the November ballot.
My biggest concern about the Medicaid expansion ballot amendment was that it put on the ballot something that had a huge ongoing general fund cost with no plan to pay for it.
The change is supported by the Department of Social Services. Venhuizen sits on the committee that crafts the state budget.
And I felt that that was pretty irresponsible. I think if you put something on the ballot that's going to have a cost, you should also have a plan to cover the cost.
South Dakota's unemployment rate is around 2.1%. It's unclear whether work requirements will result in more individuals in the workplace. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation, available data suggests Medicaid work and reporting requirements were confusing to enrollees and resulted in substantial coverage loss, including eligible individuals. Some healthcare officials are worried that will happen here. Initially, federal officials anticipated 52,000 new South Dakotans would enroll for Medicaid under expansion. Now, the state is anticipating 40,000. About half are enrolled through expansion currently. Officials say it could take up to 24 months before reaching full enrollment.
You know, we're not even making an attempt out there to enroll people, and hence our numbers are way down.
That's Democratic Representative Linda Duba, who would like to see the Department of Social Services perform outreach to get more eligible individuals enrolled and to get their routine health care covered. The Sioux Falls lawmaker also worries about who may be subject to a Medicaid work requirement.
We may have individuals that need to go on Medicaid expansion, but they also may need child care. And if they need child care and they can't afford child care because they're working, then what are they supposed to do?
Who is subject to a work requirement will get determined if the idea passes in November. There's another ballot question that has state lawmakers worried about state revenue and spending. That's the question of whether to prohibit the state sales tax on food, which could cost the state around $100 million in revenue. Sales tax collections are the state's primary source of revenue. Republican Senator Lee Schoenbeck says voters are asking lawmakers to cut revenue and increase spending.
You take all that money out of our budget and you're going to train wreck. I mean, you're not going to be talking about can you do tuition freeze. You're going to say how many of these programs that are generating the welders and the robotics and the nurses and the LPNs, how many of those are going to have to cut because you're not going to have money, period.
That will all depend on how voters weigh in November. I'm SDPB's Lee Strubinger.
Reporting on Medicaid expansion, enrollment, and work requirements. A bit later in the hour, we'll bring you his full conversation with the Department of Social Services Secretary Matt Althoff. And that conversation includes Althoff really going deeper into his thoughts on the importance of work reporting requirements for Medicaid enrollees. So now let's speak to a local healthcare advocacy group for their perspective. Shelley Tennaple is the Chief Executive Officer of the Community Healthcare Association of the Dakotas, and she's with me now in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio. Hi, welcome.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me, and thanks so much for everything you do on the show to help us understand our state and things that are going on. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. This is a primary care association. Tell me a little bit about your group.
Yeah, sure. So the Community Healthcare Healthcare Association of the Dakotas represents health centers around the state, so community health centers, and then we're privileged to be able to work with South Dakota Urban Indian Health and Oyate Health Center, which are both Native American serving organizations. We're all primary care organizations that provide behavioral health and dental care, and we're really united by that mission of fostering healthy communities and making sure that everyone who needs access to health care in the state of South Dakota can get it.
All right. Well, this is not the last time that we will be talking about this amendment as we move closer and closer to voters being able to have their say again. But what is your overall stance about work requirements and Amendment F?
Sure. I think we give Amendment F an F because really it is unneeded. And it undermines the goal that South Dakota voters really expressed when they passed the ballot initiative, which is increasing access to coverage for people in the state. I think what we already know is that South Dakotans do have a strong work ethic and they do want to work. And nationally, we see that about 61% of Medicaid recipients who are in that working age are working, and another 30% have really legitimate caregiving, health care, school responsibilities that prevent them from working. And so that's really talking about the vast, vast majority of Medicaid recipients. What we also know is that work requirements don't increase work. So there have been states that have enacted work requirements around the country. What we've seen is that it hasn't increased work, but what it has increased is paperwork, administrative burden, and really administrative barriers created at taxpayer expense that prevent people from who are really eligible for the program from getting it. So I think it doesn't accomplish the goals really that it sets out to accomplish.
All right. So a couple of the things we're hearing again and again from the proponents of this, including what you just heard in Lee Strubinger's piece and what we'll hear a little bit more from the DSS secretary. You addressed it a little bit, but let's talk about cost first. The idea that this is expensive and that it's going to become more expensive. what's wrong if most people are doing the right thing and most people are wanting to work and are motivated to work? And someone would say, well, what's wrong with providing a backstop against the people who might try to take advantage of the situation to protect taxpayers' dollars? How would you respond to that?
Sure. So just to go back to the taxpayer dollar piece, and this was something we really addressed during the ballot initiative process a couple years ago, the Legislative Research Council did an estimate of how much this would cost the state. And just a reminder that 90% of the expense of this program is borne by the federal government, and the state of South Dakota just bears that 10%. The estimate from South Dakota Legislative Research Council is really that the five-year cost of this program is almost negligible because of all the cost savings that we get to the state of South Dakota, and then also bringing millions of federal dollars into the state. And just a reminder, all of our neighbors, so Montana, Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska, they all receive those federal resources to help pay for coverage. And I think South Dakota should be included in that group. And I also just want to turn the lens a little bit because as policy people, we can be very focused on the cost to the state. But I think that cost to individuals and families and communities is also something we really need to think about. And of course, bringing those resources into the state prevents people from being bankrupted by health care needs, by having those health care conditions that go untreated and that kind of thing. So I just want to beat back, and this was something that we already had the data for a while back, and the South Dakotans were able to see that when they voted for the ballot initiative. So just to continue to, push back on that, I think having coverage really is pro-work in a lot of ways. I think what we find is that people who are able to maintain their health are also able to maintain their jobs, and poor health is associated with job loss. So we all know people with chronic conditions that need medication to keep those conditions in check. And Medicaid expansion is there as a backstop for those folks when they need it to make sure that they can maintain their health, whether that's to continue their caregiving responsibilities, their work in the community, or all the things we do to support one another in our state.
What might be some of the consequences, even if those consequences are unintended, on clinics and providers, especially in rural South Dakota communities?
Of course, yeah. I mean, these resources that are coming in to support Medicaid expansion and to support coverage for our families also support healthcare in rural communities especially. I mean, all of that rural healthcare system is fragile, and we don't have tons of resources to sustain it. And so turning away those resources at the border of our state probably doesn't make sense for our rural providers.
The other thing we hear again and again are thoughts about the dignity of work, and we'll hear Secretary Althoff say here a little bit later in the program about how we are, really put here to be in community and be of service to each other. And going to work is the way that we're compensated for that. It feels good. It creates, vibrant health and self-esteem. You'll hear him use his words later. But I, when you listen to the people having the conversation about the dignity of work and how important it is, what does that tell you about the viewpoint of the people who are leading with that and saying, we want the work requirements because, yes, work is healthy too?
Yeah, I want to be clear and say I am 100% pro-work as well, full stop. I mean, South Dakota families are too. I mean, they know they need work to put food on the table, pay their bills, all of those things. I think if I could rename this amendment, I think I'd name it the, unnecessary paperwork amendment or the taxpayer-funded bureaucracy amendment. But I think, we all support work, and I think a coverage piece is an important way to support work and enable people to stay on the job. I also just want to address just the dignity part of things as well, because, I come from an organization where our values really bring us to that space of people deserving healthcare and the importance of providing that care, whether people can write a check for it today or they can't. And so we really are driven by that value system. And I think sometimes what you can hear, and you know, not from everybody, but there is a little bit of sense of, you know, Medicaid is for people who don't want to work, or, you know, it's not said too loud, but it's kind of set off to the side. And I think that's one of the things that prevents people from signing up for coverage when they need it. And I really just want to reinforce that every developed country helps people resource healthcare costs, and it's because they're so expensive. I mean, we just saw a South Dakota Newswatch article that said it's $12,500 per person on average for healthcare in the state of South Dakota. That is not affordable for a family earning $40,000 a year. And so, you know, for me, I get coverage through my work. And that employer-sponsored coverage is supported by enormous tax breaks by the federal government. So I receive federal help getting my health coverage. My parents are on Medicaid. They receive federal help. And for those who don't get health care through their job, there's a system of Medicaid expansion up to 138% of poverty, and then subsidies and help affording insurance on the marketplace or commercial insurance up to 400% of poverty. And that's there the same way it's there for everybody. We need those resources, and we see people not taking advantage of them or not being aware of them. Mm-hmm. So we certainly want to do the work of getting out the word that that coverage is available for folks.
Right. We're going to have more on this conversation a little bit later as well. But Shelley Tennable is Chief Executive Officer of the Community Healthcare Association of the Dakotas. Thank you so much for being here with us. We appreciate your time.
Thanks.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. About 30,000 South Dakotans lost Medicaid coverage. That's following the lapse of the federal COVID public health emergency last year. That emergency required states to keep individuals on the Medicaid rolls. Now, South Dakota was one of the first to scrub those rolls, all while adding a new wave of enrollees, people who were eligible under voter-approved Medicaid expansion. So for context, we're bringing you the full interview with Department of Social Services Secretary Matt Althoff. He says last year was an unprecedented moment in the life of the Medicaid program in the state. Here is his interview with SDPB's Lee Strubinger.
States were required, and they received a federal sort of benefit to this additional federal funding in the Medicaid program to keep people enrolled. And that then ceased, that provision ceased with the end of the public health emergency as declared by President Biden. So this basically went back to routine behavior, and that is to say that every time in South Dakota when you become enrolled in Medicaid, your application is renewed. It's examined again. And we do this on an annual basis, but we also do it on an ongoing basis. What I mean by that is if not beforehand, if there isn't an incident or event or a development that happens, it will happen on an annual basis no matter what. And then there are a lot of things that happen in life that would cause these to happen more frequently than that. And so what our team did, going back to about this time last year, near the end of February, we began for them to begin to take effect what we call closures. This means that you have been on Medicaid. Upon review of your application, you are no longer eligible for Medicaid, and so you were disenrolled, or we are unwinding from the public health emergency. This was a big lift, very big lift. I'll use really rough numbers, but you know, South Dakota's Medicaid population has traditionally been about, we'll say, between 115,000 and 120,000, and through continuous enrollment, we had gone all the way up to about 154,000 people. So there's a lot of additional lives that are in theory insured in Medicaid. And our team began a process methodically. We followed all CMS guidelines, Center for Medicaid, Medicare Services, to say how many of those cases can we do. And this is a big lift for our team. I want to emphasize our team had an amazing sense of urgency because, as you're well aware, and a part of this interview I know will be about Medicaid expansion. Concurrent to this, we are also eagerly trying to ready our team to launch what the voters have requested through a constitutional amendment that was found on the ballot to enter into Medicaid expansion. And so I want to emphasize there was an eagerness and urgency to get through this unwinding very quickly because we knew that we had we wanted to be prepared, as best prepared we could be for Medicaid expansion come July 1st. So that's essentially what has gone on. It's been a, you know, what this is very labor intensive. It's every application has a scrutiny that it's given that says or examines all possible Medicaid eligibilities and then looks at all possible data that we can gather from that applicant. It requires that applicant's cooperation, I want to be very clear. So there was, you know, on the onset, there was some, we weren't getting responses from people. This is all sent out, again, by CMS guidelines, and it's all by mail, so there's a, you know, sort of a delay in the process kind of thing. But in the end, I think that we feel that we've gotten through the unwinding of the public health emergency and the continuous coverage that ensued through that very, very smoothly, quite sincerely. Our team is to be commended. I'm just so proud. There's just amazing amount of work that the Economic Assistance Division, particularly the frontline staff, there's about 100 of our specialists and leads and supervisors that are directly interfacing with the customers, those that have made application, that have been doing this very diligent work, you know, of examining every application, every possible eligibility, examining all the data that supports their income, their circumstances in life, and then making a determination based upon CMS guidelines and our state plan.
My sense is that the number of people on Medicaid is really, it's not like a static number. And so I was wondering if you could sort of maybe describe what enrollment, disenrollment, or just like a typical Medicaid qualifying individual sort of looks like. How long are they on for? I'm sure some people are on for longer. Are people on for years, months? How does that look?
I appreciate the question. I want to emphasize Medicaid has a lot of shapes and sizes. I want to be very clear about that. When we think about somebody who is, when we think about what happens in the Department of Human Services with some of the waiver programs, oftentimes these people are sort of lifelong recipients of Medicaid because of an intellectual disability or a developmental disability. If you think more closely to DSS, traditional Medicaid as we might think of it, life happens. And so the reasons why individuals through this unwinding became disenrolled was, well, they made more income, right? They got a job. And I think that's that's something that we celebrate, right? Is that the gainful employment was achieved and now they're receiving adequate income or by federal poverty level standards. And we hope to, don't always know, but with the benefit of health insurance, people move. People die. People decline coverage. You know, there's a lot of sort of voluntary elections, too, that happen. It's not, I want to be very clear, I think there's a real element to celebrate in the fact that there is this, what we would oftentimes refer to as churn. And that is something that happens all the time, right, outside of the continuous coverage that was merited during or at least required, we'll put it that way, required during the public health emergency. And so I think it's important that we all remember that. You ask about the lifetime of stay. So again, it's very feasible that somebody could receive Medicaid for a day, and at the same time they're making application, they're also making, for Medicaid, they're also making application for a job. That's a very real scenario. And so, you know, you can have approvals for Medicaid that last for a day because they got the job, right, that they were looking for. That happens, but as I said already, some are, you know, essentially lifelong. We don't know the Medicaid expansion population just yet. It's just too early to tell. I can tell you this. We've already seen that churn within the Medicaid expansion population. So I think that's a really relevant thing is life happens to this new population that we're beginning to insure through expansion. Where they may move, they may die, they may get a job and therefore gain more income. There's a lot of things that can happen in their lives too. So already though in the short 6 months, while we way too early to sort of make determinations about the whole overall population, we are seeing that they too have life happening and some of these normal events.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm sitting here with Department of Social Services Secretary Matt Althoff. I wanted to give you a chance to respond to some of the concerns by the Federal Health and Human Services kind of about the drop-off in number of children enrolled in Medicaid.
The longer I'm in the role, the more I appreciate the privilege to serve in mission with the faculty and staff of the Department of Social Services. And within that, I find a real resolve, a real commitment to do well by every South Dakotan. And for that reason, as I get to know our staff, the professionalism and the desire to do well, the desire to be well-trained, the desire to train those that we supervise, those that we mentor, I got to tell you, I have the utmost of confidence of every single one of those determinations. I really do. And I don't suspect that there's any errors here. And for that reason, I would say, while CMS might not like the results, I'm not sure that that's our responsibility. Our job in DSS is to do this objectively. Our job is to treat every South Dakotan in the exact same way, look at all the facts and align all the facts to the criteria that's been established. And so I would just simply say, I think that that's actually, it plays to our favor that while there may be concerns about the results or caution or, you know, this is a large thing, just it really honestly could be a circumstance of a really good economy. Could be a circumstance of a lot of people that have achieved gainful employment and hadn't been, you know, needing the Medicaid coverage any longer or qualifying for it. So that would be my reaction to it. I think it's an important bullet point, Lee, for you to realize, though, that South Dakota was found to be in the top five of all the 50 states through this unwinding to have merit-based. So that means it wasn't, they didn't respond to the letter, they didn't provide the documentation, we didn't hear from them. Instead, it was they got a job and the income is now exceeding the limits. They moved out of state, they died, they voluntarily declined. These are some of the things that South Dakota was found to be in the top five of all the states in unwinding for, you know, what I'll call the merit base as opposed to the procedural or the administrative reasons for closure.
Also, I wanted to give you a chance to respond to some criticism by Democratic lawmakers concerned about DSS not doing enough to maybe spread the word to individuals who qualify for Medicaid now under expansion. I guess, what do you make of that concern? Their concern being that individuals are kind of waiting until the last minute to seek medical care because they don't have insurance, but they qualify for Medicaid.
Well, a lot to unpack there. I guess I first will say I didn't receive, and most of this came through testimony that we gave to the appropriators, the Joint Appropriations Committee. I think they were expressing concern, first and foremost. So I didn't receive it as criticism of what the department was or wasn't doing, but this concern that is there. Let's remember we're dealing with Americans. And notoriously, whether you have Medicaid or if you have, you know, a managed care plan, or if you, you know, if some sort of other commercial insurance through your employer, or if you have Medicare because you're retirement age, we don't exactly lead out front on a worldwide scale of being proactive in getting health care. So I think this is, let's just put this in the right context, that this is not new, and it's certainly not a phenomenon unique to the Medicaid population that we think to get it. Now, you know, we go and we get coverage once we have a problem or we realize that I've got to go to the doctor. That being said, if I have not been in the habit of being insured, as perhaps you and I might be, where we have an annual renewal process, I think this is, you know, a part of the learning experience. If I've lived without insurance and I've known that I just can't go to the doctor because I don't have insurance, I don't think in terms of, hey, proactively get my coverage and then pay my premiums all throughout because I have a open enrollment period and I got to make sure I get enrolled because if I miss it, I lose it, kind of thing. This is all part of the learning curve, I hypothesize. I don't know this, but I think it's going to be, you know, a significant driver for why individuals were seeing this phenomenon that, you know, it's almost one in one. Those who have now become eligible through Medicaid expansion have also had a claim paid on their behalf in a very short period of time after enrollment. They had a problem. They realized they needed to get enrolled, and then they went and got the care that they were in need of. In terms of the comments about, you know, what can we do to promote that, you know, I just would respectfully point out that that's not something we do on an active basis. I don't think that's the department's role, right? The department's role is to ensure that the safety net is not only there and it's strong, but it's also catching lives and lifting it up. And we do this across many different, you know, not just Medicaid. We're very honored to be a part of the Medicaid agency for state government. But when we think about the various other divisions in the department that are also erecting a safety net, making sure its tensile strength is high, and through partnerships, because we do this a lot through partnering agencies, that's our role. And our job is not to sort of shoo people into the net. very, very sincerely about that. So, you know, I respect their concerns about it, but I think our job is to make sure that when they come upon this moment in their life that they need it, we ought to make sure, and we do our darndest to do this, to make sure that application is easy to find, application is easy to make, easy to complete to the degree that we can. I apologize that an application is lengthy. This is part of living in a just society that, you know, it's a benefit that is carved out for people who qualify, and you have to do a lot of legwork to sort of prove that you qualify. Most of that's federal, I would emphasize, and not state and that application, but that's our job. Right, is you need to be in the net. Your life is in such a place at this moment in time that you need some government assistance, and we as a people, we the American society, want for that net to be there for you at that moment. Our job is to make sure they can find that aid easily and they can get into it if they apply. Yeah.
Very recently, there were efforts to put an additional ballot question on the November ballot. It would add work requirements for the Medicaid expansion population on the ballot. Just wondered if you had any kind of reaction. I know there's concern about the amount of paperwork involved, et cetera. Thoughts as we're sitting in this moment right now about that?
Sure. Well, there are a lot of work requirements already in place in the safety net programming that DSS administers. You can't get child care assistance in South Dakota, which is a really important safety net program, unless you're either going to school or you're going to work. I mean, I'm oversimplifying. 65% of our SNAP recipients have a work requirement. There's an awful lot of this work requirement that's sort of built in. And why is that? Work is therapeutic. Work is we were made as human beings to serve others, and work is a organized way of serving others. And the reason for this is we find fulfillment. And why that's so important is when we find fulfillment, that's when we're going to sort of reclaim our sense of self-dignity, our sense of self-esteem, our belief in ourselves that we can make a meaningful contribution to the lives of others and therefore gain an income as a result of that. This is the prosperity that, this is what has earned the prosperity that America has today. So I think there's always an orientation towards this. I totally respect the fact that, can requirements be burdensome and stuff? Well, they have to be intelligent. They have to make sense and things like that. And you might be aware that there already is a work requirement on file with CMS. It's part of this whole, on traditional Medicaid. It's a federal-state partnership. And so the feds have the upper hand on this. So they've sort of passed on allowing South Dakota to implement the work requirement for the Medicaid population. But administrations change, and so that would happen. And we feel the what's known as the 1115 waiver demonstration, we feel that's a very intelligent work requirement plan that's been on file with CMS for quite a few years now, ready to be dusted off and enacted should CMS ever change its disposition.
Secretary Althoff, thank you so much for joining me on In the Moment. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Lee. It's been a privilege.
That's SDPB's Lee Strubinger talking with the South Dakota Secretary for the Department of Social Services, Matt Althoff. The Medicaid expansion conversation is complicated. It might take a few listens, so you can always find all of our coverage on our website at sdpb.org/news. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Today, let's end our show by going on a journey. We're not going to physically go anywhere today, but we will transport ourselves through the words and works of history's great travel writers. And our friend Tim Shorn is joining us now as our guide. Dr. Shorn is an associate professor of political science and the coordinator of the International Studies Program at the University of South Dakota. He is with us from SDPB Studios on USD campus there in Vermilion. Dr. Shorn, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me today.
You have a new bookstore in Vermilion. It's not new, but it was new to me. I was just there this weekend. Have you stopped by that bookstore, by the way?
I have. We have spent a little time in the game division, and
nice.
So yes, we enjoy it.
Yeah, I enjoyed visiting another independent bookstore in the state of South Dakota.
So. Yes.
All right, you are teaching an honors seminar on travel writing and travel writers. Tell us a little bit about honors seminars at USD and really who they're for and the goal of it, of offering these kinds of classes to students.
Sure. Honor seminars are for juniors and seniors in our university honors program, and it gives them the opportunity to take something out of their field, to get into a topic and look at it a bit in depth, and get to know people who they wouldn't normally run into in their coursework. So you might have a medical biology student, an ed major, an art major, and a political science major, all in the classroom learning from one of the chemistry professors. Mm-hmm. And so it's a great way for students to really look at something, not necessarily one of your usual academic topics, at least not in USD where we're somewhat limited. But it gives them a chance to look into something different. And it also gives faculty members the opportunity to delve into something that they find interesting. Maybe they have expertise in it, but aren't able to use it in their usual course load. And so the honor seminars, which are limited to 16 students, gives the professor and the students the opportunity to really engage with a unique or special topic.
All right. So you're coordinating the International Studies program. Is that what brought you to the idea that you're passionate and knowledgeable about travel writing, or was there something else at work here?
Well, I've always enjoyed reading travel writers and kind of exploring the places that I've been to and haven't been to through the eyes of someone else. And the idea of a seminar on travel writers originally got its start as the senior seminar for international studies major. But after we had curriculum changes, we didn't get to offer that course anymore. But my interest remained. Yeah. And so I thought the perfect audience for this would be our honors students who are looking for something unique and different to study for a semester.
And the people that you are elevating are fascinating because they go way back in time, and their travel is slightly more arduous than our contemporary travel. Tell us about some of these writers. Who do you want to begin with?
The person we started with this semester was somebody who had not been on my radar screen until about a year ago, mm-hmm. and that is Decimius Ausonius, who was a Roman poet, a Roman teacher. And he went traveling through parts of the Roman Empire and ended up in Germany around the Mosel River. For people who are into wine, they know that the Mosel area is a great exporter of German wine. And he approached his writing a little differently from what we have seen from other writers, and that is that he wrote his observations in a poem, somewhat disconnected at times, but it introduced people to the idea that, hey, you can see something kind of through your mind's eye by reading what someone else has experienced there. And so he's the person we first started with. And then you can move forward to someone like Ibn Battuta, who was from Northern Africa. And he traveled extensively as well, and he really became known as one of the first major travel writers. We looked at him just a little bit this semester, but I would encourage anyone who is interested in travel writing to certainly take a look at Ibn Battuta and his travels in the 1300s through much of the Islamic world.
And he is traveling for the joy of it.
He is.
Interesting to me.
Yeah. And sometimes I ran into a couple of travel writers who went traveling because it's possible that their leader encouraged them to. In other words, maybe you should just get out of town and go do something else for a while. So I'm still waiting for that. But but certainly some have encountered that. And so they took advantage of it.
Yeah. And then the rather well-known Marco Polo.
Yes. And I don't know if anyone has seen the Marco Polo series on Netflix, and I'm sure, of course, it is completely true because it's on TV. But I've seen this, that there was some concern that perhaps Marco Polo didn't write everything that is attributed to him. And certainly we see that, concern, criticism with authors throughout, the times where we've been writing books. And so I am not expert enough to say that, but whether or not he did, I do know that he went to some amazing places, and his encountering of travelers and traders and caravans was one of the things that spurred me on to learn about the Silk Road, going through Central Asia. And so he is one who has contributed a lot to not just travel writing, but to adventure and trade and seafaring, so much.
Yeah. So that gets me to this idea of the legacy and the inspiration of some of these writers, that their words matter to us today.
Right. And I look at most of the people I've read tend to be 20th century authors, and then some of them who continue into the 21st century. And those who I found most interesting were those who traveled through the Middle East. But it becomes more complicated then, because then we start to see a certain perspective. So we have members of the British Imperial Army or government going out and traveling, and it could be that they're seeing things through a rather narrow perspective themselves. Is there some prejudice involved? Is there some projection involved? Is there some judgment involved? And sometimes they tend to kind of miss the plot. One such person, Wilfred Thesiger, was a British war hero of World War II and traveled a lot, especially in the empty quarter, the desert of Arabia, the Arabian Peninsula. And he would talk about the nobility and authenticity of the Bedouins and those who traveled through the desert. And what he ended up doing was romanticizing their hard life, their suffering, making it sound like, you know, their nobility was chosen rather than, their way of life thrust upon them. And years later, after he had quit writing, he acknowledged that he had gotten that wrong, that he was looking at something through the prism that he wanted to view it through, and that perhaps this nobility and authenticity was really people going without and struggling. And so I found that interesting, because there is a literature criticism, lit crit, of travel writing that questions how some of the writers have viewed their subjects, both.
Well, and I think of fiction books like The Alchemist or a book like Siddhartha, where really, I mean, there's a lot of travel in those books. And I think I bring those up because I think a lot of people have read them or familiar with them, but they're really about the protagonist and the internal journey that they're taking.
Right.
So you have some space for that kind of romanticism. What's the difference for you between something like that and then something where, like, no, this is travel writing, and therefore it has to take an eye of accuracy and fairness and, a different sort of impact on the page?
Right, and that's an interesting question, because we look at somebody, of course, now that I'm talking to you, I've forgotten his first name, Dimbleby, who his father, I believe, was a BBC reporter, and this guy was a BBC reporter, and he went to Russia a number of times and wrote his book. But it was very clear in a significant amount of the book that this was a personal journey for him that had nothing to do with Russia. He had been through some issues in life, and I think there was probably a hoped-for opportunity that he would be able to put a lot of that behind him. But instead, you would see him struggling through his own personal life and his personal problems, while we are attempting to see Russia through his eyes.
Yeah.
And one of the I suppose greater contemporary travel writers, Paul Theroux, at times also becomes perhaps a little jaded, a little cynical, and it becomes more about his own judgment of what he's seeing going on around him rather than truly engaging with what he is seeing.
Yeah.
So that is also becoming also becomes problematic as we're reading our books.
Yeah, and I'm sure a lot of your students know who Anthony Bourdain is. Are they bringing contemporary stories to the study of someone like Ibn Battuta?
I think probably what we see is how has travel writing changed from almost a century ago to today, and the question that we have kind of implicitly walked around is, is there anything else left to see? Is there anything else left to experience? And I think we agree in the class that we all have a different perspective. And obviously things have changed over the course of 800 years or 900 years when we look at other writers. But even if we're following the footsteps of a writer who just visited someplace, 5 or 10 years ago, that there is always something new to experience and to view and to kind of interpret and see in through our own eyes, through our own life, and through our own experiences.
What do you think is behind, I'm thinking of Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie and some of the criticisms of, did he really meet these people? Was he really here? Is this a fiction book or is it nonfiction? And then all the way back to Marco Polo's having the same challenges thrown at him. Why do we as people take somebody else's story of the road and try to debunk it so aggressively?
And that's... We've thought about that. I've thought about that. I think part of it is we're amazed that somebody can have the experiences they have and encounter the people they encounter. And so sometimes we doubt that such an interaction, such an experience is even possible. I've been very lucky to have been able to travel a lot, and I've had a lot of odd experiences that people would not necessarily disbelieve.
Why are you telling me that at 12:56 and we have a minute left and I should have asked you 15 minutes ago unbelievable travel experiences.
Yeah. Well, and then sometimes where I have decided, apparently I'm going to be the dumb tourist rather than the person who is supposed to know what's going on. But there's one last person I would love to talk about.
Very quickly. Yep.
And that is Freya Stark, who was an early 20th century writer. And she was interesting in that here was a British woman traveling alone, or at least with her entourage, who would interact with the tribes of particular Arab tribes. Because she was a woman, she would be able to interact with the men of the tribes, and they would just figure, she's a woman, we can talk about anything, she won't understand it anyway. And so she got that. At the same time, as a woman, she was able to interact with the women and the children as well.
Yeah.
So she had experiences that were much more meaningful and had much more depth than her male counterparts. And I think it's interesting to see what she was able to accomplish during her time.
Okay. The lesson today is we always invite Dr. Tim Shorin to help us understand some really difficult conflicts internationally, and we need to have him on more often for detours into the work that he does teaching students about more than just the world's worst bad day. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you for having me.
You can look at Tim Shorin's OLLI classes, which is the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. There's a lot of those on Zoom. And we are going to put some of those up on our website so you can learn along with us. From all of us at SDPB, that is our show for today. We hope that it served you, and we greatly thank you for listening.